Blog Talk Radio.
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just for me has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach. Always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now, I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I'm married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell. So you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself?
Yes, does Russell really want to change that about himself? And you know, sometimes people are not necessarily ready to change. And I am Carol the Coach, Carol Jurgensen Sheets. This is the Sex Help with Carol the Coach show. It is the only show on internet radio about sexual addiction. And I am so pleased to be with you tonight. You know, I have made it my mission to interview the best of the best in this field to help you know what resources are available for you, the addict, for you, the loved one of an addict, and for anybody else who wants some information about this devastating disease. You know, I have a lot of clinicians who listen to the show who want to become experts in the field of sexual addiction. And when that occurs, I always say to them, hey, you need to get your certified sexual addictions therapist training, because that's one way that you truly can become an expert in the field of sexual addiction. And you and I both know, if you're listening to the show, that this is not an affliction, a disorder, a disease that can be helped by just anybody. And so I am very appreciative of the fact that, A, people that are certified have had the proper training. B, people that are certified typically know of experts in the field that can get them the healthiest, the quickest, because they specialize in this issue. And tonight we're going to be talking with Scott J. Watson. He is an interventionalist. And, you know, there's addiction, i.e. drugs or alcohol, and there are process addictions, and that may look like sex addiction or eating disorders. Now, the difference between an addiction and a process addiction is that one has to do with substances and the other has to do with behavior. But they both produce the exact same urges and cravings and oftentimes very much similar withdrawal symptoms. So Scott is going to be talking about what does an interventionalist do and is it appropriate for sexual addiction to call in an interventionalist to help the family to set up some guidelines, some boundaries, and some assistance in getting loved one help. Now, if you are an addict and you're listening to this show, you know, one of the things that I would believe right now is either you are in recovery or you're thinking about it. And so I hope you'll listen to this show because we're going to be giving a lot of good tips as to when does a family member need to take the next step? You know, I have always said in the past, prior to my training with Dr. Patrick Carnes, I've said, you cannot quit an addiction. You cannot learn how to manage that if you're doing it for somebody else. But now I realize that that was a misnomer, that I was giving bad advice. So let me tell you what I believe. I believe that you can initially stop a behavior, stop using a substance, and oftentimes with sexual addiction, they go hand in hand. If you love someone else and you want to stop for them. Yes, you heard it here. I never thought I'd say it, but I've truly found that to be true, that oftentimes another person is a motivating factor, is the straw that has broken the camel's back. You don't want to lose that person. You want them in your life, and you know you have to get the help you need for them. Okay, now, what that does is it gets the ball rolling. It gets the process started. And then it is up to another person, well, not another person, but to the person who has the addiction to make the decision to stop for themselves. Okay? So it's a twofold process. It may start because you love somebody and you want to stop for them, but then eventually you decide, oh, my God, this is a horrible illness. I've got to stop by myself with the help of other people, but for myself, because I'm not going to live the life I deserve unless I do. If you believe that you have a sexual addiction, you can call 646-595-3284 and we'll talk with you tonight about the addiction and about intervention. And Scott J. Watson has founded Heartland Intervention. He is a specialist. He's a mental health therapist. He does ministry. This man has kind of done it all, and he's going to be talking about, you know, when should a family become worried and decide to call an interventionist? Or he's going to be talking about what are the predictable stages that process addictions often take. When do you decide the treatment is necessary, and where do you go for treatment? It's all ever so important. And, you know, I don't know if any of you out there listening have ever used an interventionist, but I have on three different occasions. One was for alcohol. Actually, two were for alcohol, and one was for drugs. And I got to tell you, it's so interesting because at least in the experience that I had, the family, the loved ones, the coworkers, the friends, we all gathered around and identified what we loved about that person, why we wanted to see them get healthy, and more importantly, what boundaries did we have and what consequences were we going to set if they continued to hurt themselves? Not as a punitive resource, not to say, if you continue to do this, we are going to punish you, but as a resource that says, you know what? We cannot control your drinking, your drugging, or your sex, but what we can control is our involvement with you. Now, the first one had to do with a loved one. And we got an intervention together. Well, we started the process, and what we realized is that so many of his coworkers, his family, and his friends used, and they were not willing to come to the plate to talk about the fact that he had fallen asleep on a wood-burning stove. He had fallen 50 feet off of a cliff and broken almost every bone in his body. He had 10 DUIs and PIs. You know, so in other words, the only people that really had the backup to do the intervention was the family. And that wasn't enough in his case to put together an intervention. Okay, so nix that one. We actually called the support team. We had somebody come out to orient and educate us about an intervention. And because of the lack of involvement, we realized with the interventionist that it probably wasn't going to work. That was intervention number one. Never got off the ground. Nobody's fault. It just didn't have the infrastructure necessary to make a dent in this person's current functioning. Then go to number two. Good friend, loved one, a mess. She was a fabulous person, but she was absolutely an alcoholic mess. And all of her friends and family and loved ones met at hotel, talked about what we loved about her, talked about how to present that to her, talked about the horrendous memories we had of her behavior and how it affected us, and then talked about the consequences. This process took 2 days. At the end of that two-day process, we then met with my girlfriend, presented her with the information. She was shocked. She was terrified. She was hurt. She was sad. She was angry. And she agreed to go into a treatment center in Indianapolis, a drug and alcohol treatment center. We got her in, and we said, if you don't get the proper treatment, we are no longer going to have a relationship with you because we cannot watch you kill yourself like this. 3 days later, she walked out. All right, so that was an intervention that was successful in that we got her into the hospital, but she decided after 3 days that she was not going to follow through with the proper treatment. What did we end up doing? Well, I have to tell you, that was a high school buddy, someone I adored, someone who had so much potential. And I had to make the decision, as I had promised her, that if she didn't go to treatment, we would no longer be friends. And although I've heard her drinking is much better, I had to maintain that because that's what I told her I was going to do if she didn't get the help she needed. Is she still drinking? Yes. She has a debilitating illness that doesn't allow her to drink as much. But she still drinks and affects that illness, and it's a loss. There's no doubt about it. But I still hold out hope that someday she'll put that bottle down and she will make the decision to get into recovery. And when she does, I'm going to be right back with her. And you know what? That was over 25 years ago. I'm a loyal person. I don't give up on people. So I will be back in her life when she decides to take care of herself. Now, the third intervention had to do with this, a family that I worked with. And I was part of that intervention because I was the therapist that worked on the case. And I have to tell you, that intervention resulted in him going into the hospital, him being in a treatment center for 3 months, him getting the help that he so badly needed, and since then he's been in recovery about 3.5 years. So that was an intervention that absolutely produced the results that we all want. And Scott is going to be talking about, you know, when do you make the move? What are the criteria? What are the pros? What are the cons? And how you take your life to the next level to stand up for what you believe is right when it comes to being with somebody that you love that requires that intervention. So I'm very excited to be talking with Scott J. Watson, who, again, is the founder of Heartland Intervention. And, Scott, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Now, you've been in this business, is it for 11 years?
I've been in recovery for about 11 years, mostly from a substance rather than from our topic tonight. But Heartland Intervention has been around for 7 or 8 years, and it's great. I always tell people I've got the best job in the world when it goes well, and I've got one of the hardest jobs in the world when it doesn't go well. But the neat thing is I've got a front row seat to watch people's lives change. And, you know, honestly, we can sit around and talk about the problem. The really cool part is when we get to sit around and witness the solution.
Absolutely. And it, like anything else, may take a couple of different interventions or a couple of different treatment centers to really make the difference. But truly, when you gather a group of people together that tells the loved one what is precious about them as well as what their boundaries are, it makes changes. Whether it's a change you want to see or not, it definitely instills a sense of recovery. So tell me a little bit about when should a family become worried about a loved one's behavior?
Well, I think that's going to be different for every family. Certainly we all grow up with different standards and different mores and different ideas of what's acceptable. And so one of the things as a clinician we look at is what is acceptable within that family and within that community. And when someone kind of colors outside those lines, then it's problematic. Certainly by the time families get to the point of an intervention, oftentimes, like you say, they've had some treatment exposures, there's been some damage done and things like that. One of the phrases that we use, and it's not terribly clinical, but most people understand it, is that addiction is a problem when it's a problem. And so for some people, their 17-year-old son looking at a Playboy is absolutely outlandish and way over the moral edge. And yet for other people, you know, they grew up considering that kind of normal. And so we don't really weigh in on what is normal for that family. Certainly most communities have standards that we could all look at and we could nod when we see someone outside that standard. But within the context of a family, if somebody is doing something that they're feeling compelled to lie about or that is harming another person, either actually or that person feels that their boundaries or their respect has in some way been disregarded as a result of another person's behavior, then it is appropriate to certainly reach out and ask for some professional guidance. I want to say right off the top, that doesn't mean we need to rush right into an intervention. There are a lot of things that families can try before an intervention. An intervention typically comes way down the line, but we also know that the earlier we can kind of arrest these problems, typically combined with solid treatment, and as you mentioned early on, a very strong, what I like to call infrastructure, but you mentioned community, those things can really begin to arrest a problem early on.
Well, and in your experience, do you work with more people that are late teens, early adults, or 40-year-olds?
It's tough. I talked earlier today with the family of a 16-year-old, and his behavior by most any standard for a 16-year-old, be it a family standard or community standard, is way beyond what would be acceptable. But it's also not at all unusual to find someone that either has their kids go off to college, and so the dynamics at home are changed, or they near retirement age and they're worried about their viability in some way, and they reach out or act out sexually in a way that many people would feel is not characteristic of what they believe that person to be. And so really, one of the things that we like to say is that addiction and problematic behaviors have no barriers. And by that we mean it can be old, it can be young, it can be black, it can be white, it can be Catholic, Protestant, Jewish, Hindu, Islam, those who have no real integrated faith structure. And that's one of the important things to keep in mind, is it impacts the rich and the poor from the East Coast to the West.
Well, that's a good point. And certainly you talked about process addiction. So what's the difference between a process addiction and another type of addiction?
Well, there's a sense in which there's a huge difference, and there's a sense in which there's not much of one. So let's start with the ways in which they're similar. Typically, one of the things that we look at when we use this term addiction is, are you using a substance or a behavior to modify your mood?
And so certainly when someone smokes marijuana, drinks alcohol, or uses one of the more illicit drugs, it's easy for us to say that, yes, they're using cocaine, they're using LSD, they're using alcohol to modulate their mood. But what about the person that uses anger? What about the person that uses the perceived element of control? What about the person that uses sexual gratification? What about the person that uses gambling or shopping or cleaning, all in an effort to try to modulate mood and create this illusion of control? So in that sense, they're very, very similar. In another sense, though, as you mentioned, they're very, very difficult. Certainly there is no physiological detox that comes from changing my sexual behavior or changing the way in which I spend money or I shop. However, there may be a change in my mood because I am relinquishing my behaviors, which have caused problems, have been problematic either to me or legally or to my family members. And so while the heroin addict might get what we call dope sick, muscle cramps sick to their stomach, while the alcoholic might get the tremors, certainly there are some mood things, but we don't have to put someone in a medically supervised detox when they change their sexual or their gambling patterns.
And, you know, when was the first time you were asked to do an intervention on somebody that had a sexual addiction? Because, you know, this is a fairly new field. I tell my listeners, if you have an addiction or if you love someone who does, you're really kind of pioneers in the field. It's been around for a while, but it's only been talked about probably for the last, well, since about 1985.
Well, I think that's right, and certainly there was a landmark study that came out in the early 90s. The fact of the matter is I had a couple of careers prior to getting into mental health and addictions, and so I'm probably a latecomer to the field. But within the work of Heartland Intervention, actually we did one of our very first interventions was someone that struggled both with a chemical problem but also with sex addiction. And so we did the intervention, and it was successful, and we sought to put this person in a treatment center that was able to handle both his sexual addiction, which was pronounced and very problematic within the confines of the family, and his chemical addiction, which actually medically was a bigger concern, but had not yet trickled down into it was not something that the family was probably as aware of and certainly not as concerned about.
Mm-hmm. And I'm glad you brought that up because I certainly talk on the show about how often drugs or alcohol are fused with sexual addiction, and it really becomes a two- or three-pronged problem. You know, there is addiction to substances in addition to the sexually addictive behavior. So it sounds like one of your first experiences, somebody had at least two, if not three, of those issues.
Exactly, and we haven't even talked about whether or not there's an underlying or an overarching mental health component that might either be masking or be fueling or being fueled by one of the behaviors that you mentioned.
Mm-hmm. So say a little bit more about that, because our listening audience may not realize that there may be mental health issues that contribute to this problem.
Yes, definitely. And so one of the things that someone will say when they call the office is, well, I'm not sure if he's got a substance problem or a sex problem or if he's just depressed. And one of the things that you know and that I try to educate the families on, we can't do a good job diagnosing their mental health as long as they're engaging in these other behaviors. So when someone drinks alcohol, it's a depressant, and so we would expect them to be depressed. If someone is working really hard and lying about and experiencing some real anxiety about their sexual behavior, that can mask itself in shame, which can also look to the non-clinician like depression. And so one of the things that we try to do is remove the substances, except those that are prescribed by a doctor, remove the behaviors that we believe to be harmful, get a psychiatrist or an addiction specialist to look at the medicines that are prescribed and see if they're consistent with long-term recovery. And at that point, once we get the brain cleaned up a little bit, then we can diagnose and get a pretty good picture of what's going on from a mental health standpoint.
Yeah, and so oftentimes people with bipolar depression or obsessive-compulsive disorder or anxiety disorder medicate with sex. and so, and other substances. So they typically, too, have a mental illness or a mental health problem that is part of the problem.
I had a client just a few weeks ago, and he came to me because he is in a Department of Transportation covered safety-sensitive job. So you can think that he's a truck driver or a pilot or an air traffic controller or drives a school bus, something like that, and he had flunked a drug test. During the course of his assessment, we sent him off to treatment, and it was there, as you just mentioned, that a lot of sexual identity and sexual behavior stuff started to come up. And again, we thought we had just sent him for a substance problem. But over time, he began to be honest, and we began to get a much clearer picture of who this guy really was. And that didn't throw us off our game, and we weren't mad at him. What we were doing able to do, was to really offer him the help that he needed so that he could eventually get back to work, and we not only look after him, but obviously in a safety-sensitive situation are charged with making sure that all of us that travel on the roads with someone like that are safe. So it really turned out well, but it didn't start out well because, like you said, there was an underlying issue that was kind of muddying the waters.
Absolutely. Now, would you say that you oftentimes get a call from loved ones or from employers, or from friends? I mean, where does the referrals come from?
Almost always from loved ones. The ones that we get from employers tend to go like this. I'm the HR director, or I'm the technology director, and we have discovered something on the server that is very concerning to us. And so typically that's someone that's either been accessing adult material or storing adult material on a company server. And so they want to know how to proceed. And one of the things that I say to employers all the time is, hey, we live in a big boy age now where technology is a big, big deal. And we can do things technologically that 20 years ago we would have never dreamed possible. And so it's important for employers to have policies. You know, what does your company policy say if you catch an employee looking at pornography or storing illicit images on the company server? And certainly not only illicit images, but what about illegal images? So it's important that a company have a policy so that it is not left up to, oh, you know, it's just Joe. He's our best employee. He's been here for a long time. Or, ooh, it's Steve. We never really liked him. Now we have a reason to fire him. That opens a company up to a lawsuit. If you have a policy, now you're in a situation where you can work the policy, and policies can be written to provide a great deal of flexibility. A lot of the phone calls we get certainly are from loved ones. They're from children. They're from spouses. They're from parents that are concerned. And oftentimes those are some of the most desperate and sad calls that we get. The good news is help is available.
Well, that's a good point. Now, you know that there tends to be predictable stages the process addictions often take. And I was wondering if you could talk tonight about what some of those predictable stages are.
Well, there are. There are a number of predictable stages. One of the stories that I like to tell, if we've got time for a quick story, is this idea of control. And certainly one of the first criteria that we look at when we diagnose this is this idea of the loss of control. And yet that is so difficult because the person that we're talking about is almost always the last one to know when they've lost control. It's the story of a guy going down the road on a snowy, icy day, and he hits a patch of ice. And behind him is a grandmother and her very young grandchild. And the grandchild looks at this guy hit a patch of ice and begin to fishtail to the right, and the little child looks at grandma and says, "Grandma, dude's going in the ditch." Meanwhile, in the car in front, dude turns the wheel to the right and saves it and fishtails to the left. And then he turns the wheel to the left and it fishtails back to the right. And the little boy in the back car is saying, "Look, he's going in the ditch." And the dude's thinking as he slides right in front of a semi and just misses it, "See, I've got this." And then lo and behold, he does end up next to the ditch. And the boy screams one last time, "Grandma, he's going in the ditch." And the first thought to go through dude's mind when he ends up down at the bottom of the ditch is, "Well, that's not too bad. I believe I can drive this out."
Mm-hmm.
Addiction is the same way. You know, for so many of the loved ones and the family members and the employees and the neighbors, they realize that the life is spinning out of control, and yet that person thinks they've got it, that it's not that bad, that they're going to be able to drive their life out of the ditch. And so that's one of the primary hallmarks that we look at. Certainly we look at compulsive behavior. Certainly we look at an effort to stop the behavior, and generally those efforts are certainly longitudinally over the long run, they're not successful. But sometimes in the short term, they are successful, and that provides hope to the family. But eventually, over time, the person acts out again. We look at a loss of time. So it's not just the amount of time that someone is acting out, but it's the time that they spend leading up to, obsessing about it, acting out, and recovering from. We look at their preoccupation with it. We look at whether or not they've missed obligations. In other words, I'll never forget the person that said, I've never reneged on any of my family obligations because of my problem. And the wife said, almost instantly, yes, but you're never able to coach the 8 a.m. soccer games.
Mm-hmm. So
the
10 o'clock really means
games,
from his own filter, that he's never missed
exactly
anything. There's so much more that he's missed that he doesn't even realize because of the denial of the addiction.
That's right. And that's why we as clinicians have to make sure that we get that collateral interview from the other people. We always ask for someone to do an honest assessment and to allow the family to weigh in too.
Well, and I was going to ask you, because I had shared some processes that I had been through with some interventions, both for a client, a friend, and a family member. So if they were going to work with you at Heartland Interventions, what would they do? What would be expected of them? I don't know if you do it differently per each family or if there's a standard procedure.
Well, certainly every case is a little bit different, but we have a couple of absolutes. And one of the main absolutes is when we do an intervention, we always use a loving approach. By the time someone gets to us, they've tried begging, they've tried yelling, they've tried pleading, they've tried moral platitudes, they've tried threats that were either carried out or weren't carried out. One of the beautiful things about the way we do interventions, and I'll credit Jeff and Deborah Jay, it is their book that really serves as our complete roadmap for how we do interventions at Heartland.
Mm-hmm.
We come at it from a loving perspective because we believe that addiction, whether it's process or chemical, part of that is anger, part of that is denial, part of that oftentimes is not telling the truth. And we know that love will pierce through that anger and that denial way better than screaming and yelling and blaming and threatening. So the first standard that we always look at is it's going to be loving. The second thing that we always look at is we use the element of surprise. We don't let someone know that this is coming. Having said that, we don't come in like a SWAT team. It's loving and it's respectful. And we simply say that we've got some people here that love you and care about you, that want what's best for you, and are you willing to talk to us or are you willing to listen to us for a few minutes? And once we have that buy-in from them, then we simply sit down and we share our thoughts that your behavior is driving a wedge between you and me. And we're here today not because we're angry at you, but because we're concerned about you. I want our relationship to be restored, and are you willing to get the help that we're offering today? Prior to that, of course, we have everything set up with a treatment center. We use only the best treatment centers from all throughout the country. We believe that it needs to be a good clinical fit, and then it also needs to be a good fit with whatever's going on in the family. So if the family has a strong faith predisposition for or against or of some particular flavor, we certainly want to keep that in mind. If it's a professional that holds a clinical license in the state, we would want to get them out of state so they're not sitting in group with one of their potential patients. So there are a number of different factors. Cost and whether or not someone has insurance that will pay for it is a big factor. A number of different factors, but those are the primary ones, and then we work with each family to tailor an intervention that we think will be successful for their loved one.
Well, and you mentioned cost, because obviously there's a cost to intervention and then there's a cost to treatment. And is there a sliding fee scale, or is it pretty much standardized for everybody?
It's not standardized at all. In fact, one of the things that I would tell your listeners, if they're considering using an interventionist, and we can talk about considerations for whether or not you need a professional interventionist or whether or not you can just buy Jeff and Deborah's book and do it yourself, which would not be a bad way to go because it's a great book. But certainly there are some factors. So I would encourage people to shop around, talk not just about theoretical orientation of interventionists, talk not just about the style and the model that they use, because we don't all use the same model, but also talk about price, because it varies a great deal. Certainly there are interventionists in this country that charge a lot of money, and by that I mean somewhere between, you know, $6,000 and $10,000 for one intervention. There are also those of us that try to keep it affordable. You know, one of the neat things about being an interventionist, as I said at the beginning of the show, is I've got a front row seat to see people's lives change. But those lives aren't as likely to change if we can't get them into treatment. And so I would, while I need to get paid and I need to eat like everyone needs to eat, for the most part, once that happens, I want to see people get into an affordable treatment exposure, because the payoff, besides what I make for a living, is seeing lives change, and that's really the very, very cool part.
Oh, absolutely. And so what I heard you saying is that certainly people might pay a variety of fees depending on who they use for an intervention, and that certainly you're willing to work with the family based on what their financial situation is and or refer them to the proper resources if they need that.
Absolutely. I'm located in central Indiana, and so if I'm doing an intervention that's in central Indiana, is it okay that I tell you what I charge? I mean, it's not a big secret.
Absolutely, yeah.
An intervention in central Indiana is generally going to cost somewhere right around $2,000 if Heartland Intervention does it. Now, it's going to be a little bit more than that if we're traveling with people. And a lot of interventionists will charge a greater fee, and then they will just plan on traveling. We try to make it as affordable as possible. One of the things that we found, Carol, is that most families have enough structure, enough integrity of structure still, that they can find what I like to call a non-reactive family member to travel with them. You know, now, if brother and sister are oil and water, that's not who we want going to treatment. But generally, we can find an aunt or an uncle, or sometimes it's the spouse or parent, but less often, to travel with that person. There's no reason that the interventionist needs to travel. However, if the family would feel more comfortable with that, or if there's a clinical reason, certainly we're happy to do that, but at an additional charge. We want intervention to be affordable because we want people to get into treatment. That's where the miracle happens.
Well, absolutely. So, okay, let's go through this a little bit. What resources would you say are available to the spouse who feels damaged and hurt in cases of sexual infidelity and addiction, since this is obviously something you're working more and more with?
Well, there are a number of different things. And one of the things that I would say is the spouse, and let's assume for the purposes of discussion that it's a wife, it's critical that she find a therapist that she is comfortable with. One of the things that I think I know about sexual addiction is the spouse always takes it very, very personally, and the person who is the addict or who is acting out will look me right in the eye and say it had nothing to do with her. And people will hear that, and they will shake their head, and they will say, how can it be? And yet that has happened over and over and over. And while there might be a little bit of overlap there, oftentimes, like I said, the addiction or the acting out is about modulating mood or finding gratification. It's generally not because one finds their spouse abhorrent in some way. And yet it's a horribly, horribly damaging wound. I am not a primary therapist, but the spouse needs to find one that she can trust, because at some point there are many therapists who feel like there needs to be what I call the big disclosure or the big reveal. And that, of course, needs to be done ever so delicately after there's been a great deal of work done individually by both the husband and the wife, because the most cruel thing in all of therapy would be, in an effort to try to provide healing, to re-traumatize one of the two participants.
Very, very interesting. And I would agree with you 100%. You know, I always say Certainly guilt and shame are the clouds that follow the addict, but the actual trauma and pain tends to be with the partner who is constantly shell-shocked by the information, the behavior, the infidelity, the betrayal, and all the things that a partner deals with when she discovers the sexual addictive behavior of her partner.
One of the things that I like to say, and it sounds empty, and I almost feel empty saying it, but it's the truth. I like to look into her eyes as non-judgmentally as possible and say, you didn't cause it, and you can't fix it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure that really helps, because obviously anybody who loves someone with addiction wonders what they could have done differently or what they did to contribute to the problem. So that makes a lot of sense. So now, what resources then are available to a partner?
Initially she's going to want a therapist, someone that can guide her kind of preliminarily. But there's also a lot of work that she can do. There are a lot of books out there, and some of us learn better from books. I'm always a little bit leery to recommend self-help books because I think oftentimes we read what we read through our own filter, and that's not always helpful. But certainly things that can be useful are 12-step groups like Al-Anon. There are such groups for those that are dealing with sexual addiction. In addition to that, just some basic boundary work. There's a wonderful book out. I think it's just called Boundaries. And it's written a little bit from a spiritual perspective. And so I always like to throw that out there because there are some who deal with that better than others. But I've had people that are not especially theological in their persuasion, and they've read the book, and they've still been able to benefit from it. So that's a book that people have found useful. I think the key is to begin to heal with a professional therapist, begin to engage in a support group or a 12-step group that will allow for you to normalize your feelings and to voice your feelings, for you to realize this therapeutic factor of universality, which is a fancy way of saying you're not the only one. Others have been there before. And so this idea that I'm chronically unique in my pain, in my shame, and in my damage, there's something beautiful that happens when three or four ladies can sit together or eight or ten ladies can sit together and they can look into each other's eyes and realize that they're not the only one. That's wonderfully therapeutic. Also in the context of a group, catharsis, which is just getting it off my chest, having a safe place to tell my story and to seek my truth, because all of the focus was on my addict husband, and now he's off of treatment and everyone's worried about him, and I'm left here to deal with children and money and on and on and on, and that can be a very, very, very lonely place.
Oh, 100%. And, I admire the fact that you're recommending 12-step groups, because certainly COSA, which is for partners of sex addicts, is very helpful, and there are a couple of meetings here in Indianapolis. But since this show is heard all over the world, I would encourage you to go to COSA.org to find out where these 12-step programs are for partners, just like there was SA.org or SAA.org to help with 12-step recovery if you are the addict.
Let's take a minute and just talk about why we like 12-step programs and why we like the group thing. You mentioned guilt and shame, and so when someone has this shame floating around, and that's a word that we've heard since we were little, but clinically what it looks like, I think, is this tape in my head that says, I'm damaged, I'm not good enough, I'm a disappointment, I don't measure up, I'm chronically unique. And if anyone finds this out, they'll bail out on me too. And so there's something beautiful about being with a group of people and sharing the information on that tape inside my head, and they actually sign up to care about me and to love me and to be there for me in spite of the fact that they know a lot about me. And that is just an amazing experiential therapy that all the king's horses and all the king's men with all of our masters and PhDs haven't been able to trump. It's just a really, really, really neat thing, and that's one of the reasons, in addition to the actual step work, but that's one of the reasons that we like groups, is because there's just something really cool that happens. When you get to know me, and all the silly things I've done and all the silly things I think, and you choose to be with me anyway.
Absolutely. And, I mean, obviously you speak from experience because you said at the beginning of the show you've been in recovery how many years?
A little over 11.
And I'm just curious, was an intervention needed for you?
I did not need an intervention. However, I, shortly after getting into recovery, was a part of somebody else's intervention, long before I became a therapist, long before I had any desire or it was ever on my radar. And so I had had a little bit of an exposure. This was before the TV show or anything like that, and it was just kind of interesting. So I had a little bit of an exposure to one, but no, an intervention's not part of my story.
And how did that intervention work for the person that you knew? I mean, if you heard me talking at the beginning of the show, obviously, out of the three interventions, one worked. One, there weren't enough people to actually create the intervention as we had hoped. And the other one, she left AMA, although her drinking is much more regulated now. I personally have not had anything else to do with her because I said, if you don't get help and stay in treatment, I can't be around you. And it's not meant to be a punishment. It's about me taking care of myself and my boundaries. So,
well, that's the thing. When we talk about bottom lines, and the answer to your question of how did it go for that guy, it went poorly. And then about 5 years later, he made a very, very, very public mistake that landed him on the front page of the paper. And it took that for him to get into recovery, and I actually had a note from him today, and he's doing really, really well. Back to your comment, though, about protecting myself, this idea of a bottom line during the intervention oftentimes is misperceived. Oftentimes people feel like a bottom line is something we're going to do to the person that we're intervening on if they don't go to treatment, and it's not that way at all. As you said, a bottom line is a statement to support recovery and to no longer allow the current trajectory as far as it is up to me. It's a statement to protect myself and to maintain a well-defined boundary. The fact of the matter is the bottom line never, ever, ever has to happen or has to even be known if the person agrees to go to treatment. We don't ever use the bottom lines until we've read all the letters and the person says to each member of the loving family that is gathered there, no, 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 no. And then, because we want to be respectful, I always say, we want to make sure so that you're clear on what they're prepared to do to support recovery and to no longer enable this trajectory. In other words, we want to make sure you're clear what you're saying no to. And then they very calmly read the decision that they've made, as you say, to enforce this boundary and to protect myself. You know, in my own family, Carol, we didn't have an intervention, but we simply said one time, on Thanksgiving, we're going to give you a choice. If you have, I'll change his name, Steve, on Thanksgiving, our family will be there. But when Steve gets drunk and acts silly, we will leave. Mm-hmm. And the other family member said, you mean before we've had the turkey? I said, absolutely before we've had the turkey, because my wife and my kids did not sign on for Steve's silly games, when they came along. And so then there's a choice. You can either not have Steve or you can have Steve and roll the dice that his behavior will hang in there until the turkey's carved.
Right, and you're taking care of your family and dealing with your family in a way that protects them and also honors what you want to do or what you need to do.
Exactly, especially where there are younger kids. You know, we didn't want our younger children growing up thinking that Steve's behavior was normal.
Right, right. Well, and again, that's where the book Boundaries comes into play, and it can be so helpful. And you're right, it does have kind of a religious/spiritual component to it, but as far as I'm concerned, it is the best book on boundaries. I am right now thinking about now, who was the author? It was actually, I think, two authors, and I'll look that
right
up while we're talking.
I think it was Henry Cloud was one of them.
That's right.
And the other one, his name escapes me. But I think if someone were to put the Boundaries book in Google, many, many, many hits for that will come up. It's a well-known and actually easy-to-access book.
Well, now, as we begin to wrap up for today, can you tell me a little bit about, Oh, the myths of addiction, and typically what people may wonder and become confused about when it comes to addiction.
I think the biggest myth that we hear all the time is that there's no point in getting someone help until they're ready. The problem with that myth is this. Oftentimes, if we wait for someone to hit bottom, bottom comes with a loss of job, with a loss of a relationship with someone that they love, and sometimes it even means a loss of freedom or a loss of life. And so especially when we're talking about risky sexual behavior, paying for sex, engaging in dangerous sexual behavior, in some extreme cases, engaging with behavior of those that are not yet of an age of majority, that's going to come with a loss of freedom. And so if we allow that to continue and we allow for them to hit bottom or to get ready, that's really not caring and loving at all. With an intervention, one of the things that we try to do is to raise their bottom so that we can get them help before all those things have to go away. It's a very popular myth, but sadly, we don't think it's the right thing to do. We find that to be a cruel way to handle it, to just allow someone to continue until they've lost it all.
Well, that makes sense. And so what you're really saying, you said earlier, which is, More often than not, the earlier the better. If the behavior is really problematic and people continue to stay in denial, maybe that's a teenage boy who's 17 or 18 and doesn't realize that the anonymous sex he's having through the internet may end up bringing him, putting him in a situation that not only endangers him but the family. And certainly we're seeing more and more of this with females, young females who are 14, 15, 16, and 17. Those kids are appropriate for interventions, as certainly adults are also.
They are. The difficulty with intervening on those that are not yet 18 in Indiana and in some other states are, you know, in Indiana, if mom and dad say you're going to treatment, get in the car. You really don't have the element of choice. And one of the things that we try to do is to provide someone with the opportunity to say no, as long as they understand what the bottom lines are, because we feel like that's the respectful thing to do. But you're right. Getting someone help, and again, there are different levels of care. We're not always talking about putting someone on an airplane and flying them halfway across the country. Within central Indiana and within the states where any of your others might be listening, with the exception maybe of some exceedingly rural areas, there are good therapists locally that can begin to alter these behaviors, to work with people to alter behaviors, to plug them into 12-step groups, to help to institute some of this, what I call infrastructure, things like accountability, things like structure, things like looking at some point as to what might be behind these different behaviors that are maladaptive, that are not sustainable. And so there is help that's available, and it is available for those that are at the very young end of the spectrum and also for those that are markedly older.
And so how do you access treatment centers that are available in London or, you know, Sacramento, California? I mean, how does somebody like yourself figure out what is the best treatment center?
Well, you know, that's what we get paid to do. And I'm not naive enough to think that I know every one of them, nor am I naive enough to think that we're familiar with all of the very, very best ones. Well, what I do tell our clients is, the ones that we use, I am confident they are among the very, very best. What I typically do is I will give a list of three, oftentimes the three, sometimes just two, but almost always three treatment centers, and I'll tell the families what I think I know about them, what I think they're good at, what I think maybe they aren't as good at, what I think they'll cost, what I think their treatment modalities are, and what I think their outcomes are. And then the family ultimately is the one that picks the best fit. However, I tell them that the three that they get, there won't be a clunker on the list. They'll be picking between great, great, and great.
Well, that totally makes sense. And so you're basically saying, yes, I may not have personal experience with each one of these treatment centers, but you've done the research. You know what it has had the best results in terms of both clients and clinicians saying, this program really was effective, and you recommend the best in the area.
Right, and I would say that it would be very, very unusual that we would send someone to a treatment center that I've not visited. I like to tour treatment centers. I like to get to know their clinical staff. I like to find out whether or not the cafeteria food is as good as they tell me it is. And it's always good, if they'll let me, to get an opportunity to give just kind of a generic recovery lecture to the folks that are inpatients there. I was out of state last week, and I gave two recovery lectures in treatment centers, and it was fun for me. Hopefully it was useful for them, but I also gained a real understanding of both of those treatment centers so that I have a feel for what they're good at.
Well, that makes sense, too. And so this is your full-time gig? You do not do therapy in addition to intervention?
I generally have between 4 and 6 therapy clients at any one time. I'm also a DOT substance abuse professional, so I do a great deal of substance abuse assessments. And then, as you may or may not know, with that comes recommendations for education and treatment and some treatment facilitation. We also get a lot of people who don't need an intervention. They're sick and tired of being sick and tired, and they know they need help. And so the family will just call and they'll say, hey, my 22-year-old son is sick of doing heroin. Where should we send him? He's ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
And so
mm-hmm.
then it's just a matter of getting him plugged or her plugged in somewhere that will do a good job with whatever substance or behavior we're talking about. Will be a good fit clinically and a good fit demographically, and that's neat when that gets to happen.
Well, I bet. So now, as we begin to end, tell people how they can get a hold of you if they want to pursue an intervention here in the Midwest.
Sure. Easiest way to find me, my web presence is at www.heartlandinterventionsingular.com, and phone number is easily remembered, 877 makes it toll-free, 752-8811, and the email, they can just email info@heartlandintervention.com.
Okay. Well, Scott Watson, it sounds like you're very passionate about what you do, and obviously you called it when you said you get to see people maybe at their darkest moment make changes because they really committed to a process by which it teaches them how to make those changes. And that's what this kind of business is all about. I so appreciate your wisdom and wish you the best. And I hope that people will contact you across the country to find out how they can either utilize your services or find somebody close to home. So thank you again.
Carol, it's always a pleasure. Hopefully we'll be able to do it again.
All right. Thanks again. Bye, Scott.
Bye.
All right, that was Scott Watson, and he is a founding member of Heartland Intervention, and obviously he said not everybody needs an interventionist. There may be bibliotherapy that can help you. It may require an excellent therapist who has wisdom in your particular niche. You know, if you got a sexual addiction, I highly recommend a certified sexual addictions therapist because they have been trained to know how to intervene, not as an interventionalist, but as a specialist in this business. And unfortunately, and fortunately, that's what this kind of process takes. So I really want to encourage you to consider finding out about intervention. If you have somebody that you love who just doesn't seem to realize the consequences of their behavior, you know, find out more about that. And thank God for the intervention shows on television, because at least it brings some light to the process. It's a little Hollywood, but it gives you information. Now, next week, we are going to be talking about sexual addiction from Timberline Knolls. It's a treatment center here in the Midwest. Looking forward to that. And so stay tuned every Monday night at 9 o'clock p.m. Eastern Standard Time for more sex help with Carol the Coach. I'm Carol Jurgensen-Sheets, a.k.a. Carol the Coach. You can email me at any point at carolthecoach@aol.com or visit my website, www.sexhelpwithcarolthecoach.com. Have a great week, and I'll see you back here, same time, same place.